This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, what happens when a nation loses count of its people? It's a situation Papua New Guinea is trying to resolve. Extreme drought hits part of the northern Pacific, and we'll look at what happens when a country runs out of lawyers. We'll have more on those stories coming up. It's a few years late, but the government of Papua New Guinea has officially launched the country's biggest population survey. The last national census conducted in 2011 is thought to be wildly inaccurate, undercounting the number of citizens by a massive 20%. Experts say the latest count needs to be properly funded to ensure accuracy and guide future government decision-making. The ABC's reporter in Papua New Guinea, Belinda Cora, with more.
Papua New Guinea is by far the Pacific's largest country with an estimated population of 11 million, but that is the problem. The country's last census failed to accurately calculate its population, and it's something the country wants to change.
You come in as businessman, businesswoman, or tourist, or work in the NGOs, or work in a public service, or in the private sector, or you're just passing through, you must be counted also. In this occasion, on the 16th of July, rather 16th of June this year, until 29th or 31st when it is completed, every human being in Papua New Guinea must be counted. Is that okay?
Launching the census last week, PNG Prime Minister James Marape spoke on why it is important and why it should also include non-citizens living in the country. And he has a strong message for all school leavers and university students.
They are savvy. They're engaged in Facebook right now. They're engaged in WhatsApp right now. They're in our society. And so through this occasion, I want to rally and mobilize all who have left grade 12, who have not found any place in our universities or colleges and in community. You come out right now, tomorrow starting, report to your district administrator or your provincial administrator. We want to know you. Get yourself counted.
The Prime Minister also has a message for all unemployed youths.
We will launch our program in Port Moresby City for all grade 12 graduates who are in city doing nothing. And this may also go out to all who have left colleges and universities who are unemployed as we speak. You come out. In this census, we want to know you first. You are an important contact point for us in society. You come out and you will partner the public servants in the count that we must do for yourself, your family, your people, and our country collectively.
Mahalopo Lavelle is a local economist who is now a FDC Pacific Fellow at the Lowy Institute in Australia.
The year 2000, in the 2011 census was faulty. So observers noted that, at least estimated that there was an undercount by about 20% of the population then in 2011. And so we really don't know. Very important demographic data, and this census will really fill that gap.
He says for this census, the most important factor is a commitment by government to ensuring sufficient funds to carry out the survey.
It's really a question of if the funds are adequate and if the funds can be accessed on time. And the opposition government has pointed out that there are lower funds that have been allocated and have been requested by the National Statistics Office, so that's a worry. But really, the census is it's very important. It needs to be done. The PNG government needs to work closely with its development partners, particularly with expertise in population counting. So, for example, the UNFPA, the Australian government, particularly the Australian Bureau of Statistics, academics as well.
Mr. Lavelle adds that the governance and planning of such important surveys must be taken into account, including assistance required from outside the country.
And it needs to conduct it in the time frame that it's already planned to set it out. And really, it can't afford to have this census fail, like the 2011 census fail. We've seen really large, major national exercises really leave a lot to be desired. So, for example, the 2022 elections was really regarded by most observers as an election that failed. The election before that in 2017 was regarded as an election that failed, right? And a lot of the problems involved in both those two elections plus the 2011 census have not really been addressed. So it's really addressing the capacity constraints within the National Statistics Office, really empowering the anti-corruption agencies and the departments, particularly the Department of National Planning that has oversight over the National Statistics Office.
And that was the Lowy Institute economist Maholopa Lavelle ending that report from Belinda Cora in Port Moresby. Dry conditions in parts of the Northern Pacific have led to severe water shortages on some islands. As Dubravka Volodya reports, it comes as the U.S. Drought Monitor has upgraded conditions on Wat TJ in the Marshall Islands and on Yap in the Federated States of Micronesia from severe conditions to extreme.
Isidore Robert is worried. It has not rained in parts of Marshall Islands for months, and there's very little drinking water left for the population of some 9,000 people living on the smaller northern islands and atolls. Mr. Robert, who's the Marshall's Disaster Management Office's director, says they have sent aid to affected communities.
Delivering what we have, a portable reverse osmosis machines that we go install badly affected areas. Some atolls and islands have invested in these kind of machines. The ones that do not have are the ones we've been responding to.
So does that mean you ship or you air freight water there, or how does it work?
It's a case by case. So there are instances where we had to fly it in due to availability of transportation, or vice versa. We had to ship it cold by ocean due to availability of flights.
Meteorologist Landon Adlett says many of the area's smaller islands depend solely on rainwater.
You have a mix of the higher islands. Those are islands with mountains and vast jungles. And then you have the low islands. Those are the outer islands, small islands that are about 5 to 10 feet above sea level, and also those coral atolls. Their drinking water source is only from the rainfall. And so when the rain stops, there's very limited and a waning supply of drinking water availability.
Mr. Adlett, who's with Guam's National Weather Service, says Yap in Micronesia and Wat here in Marshall Islands are hit hardest.
With no rainfall, they have no fresh drinking water supply coming in from natural sources. So that all has to be shipped in from relief vessels or from reverse osmosis units.
He says bringing aid to some areas is challenging.
There's been some tight moments across some of the outer islands because it does take time to get vessels into some of these islands that don't have a grass runway strip for small planes to come in. So right now we're not in a dire situation, but things are escalating. And the longer it takes before the rains return, we're going to have to keep the full pressure on these response efforts.
Parts of the Commonwealth of the Marianas, Palau and Guam are also experiencing dry conditions. But while Guam's groundwater levels are full, so they are not worried about shortages, Mr. Adlett says they're concerned about fires.
It's more the wildfire threats, because we've not had a robust wildfire season in a number of years. So now all this vegetation started to dry out. And so we're looking at the higher likelihood of increasing fire danger across the island here. Right now, it's a proactive messaging campaign to prevent outdoor burning. That we're sharing that information on how to prevent fires and how to be fire safe.
The dry spell is also affecting crops in some areas, with the leaves of some trees already turning brown. The authorities say they're planning to send food aid should things get worse. Mr. Robert in Marshall Islands says they are managing for now.
It's pretty bad, but it's not as bad where we have to seek external assistance. We can manage it within our own government.
More heavy rains are forecast for most of the areas, but not until June.
And that was the ABC's Dubravka Volodya with that story. Members of the body that regulates the shipping industry, the International Maritime Organization, have committed to creating the world's first global carbon price, which means shipping companies who produce around 3% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions will now pay a fee for every ton of carbon they produce from burning fuel. Dr. Peter Natal, the technical and scientific advisor to the Micronesian Center for Sustainable Transport, says the IMO members now have to decide what form the levy will take and how it will be collected and how the money will be used.
Whether that's to be the proposal that the Pacific has advocated for, which would be a flat-based levy, or some sort of complicated trading mechanism is still yet to be decided. But the proposal put forward by the Pacific for a flatline levy is obviously great, gaining strength. We went into the debate with 9 Pacific Island countries. We came out of the debate with all those Pacific Island countries joined by, I think, 8 Caribbeans and at least a couple of Africans. And there's been a steady stream of phone calls from across the Global South to our negotiating teams in the past week. So, yeah, the levy is definitely gaining traction at this stage.
And what do you and the other Pacific states who are backing it say is the benefit of this model, the flat levy, as opposed to the other two?
I mean, it's simply the most ambitious of the three measures and the strongest pricing signal. We've agreed at the IMO and in the revised strategy we all adopted last year that there were three basic jobs we had to do. We had to promote the energy transition of shipping, we had to incentivize the fleet, and we had to contribute to a just and equitable transition for all states. And it's that last one that's causing all the issues, because most of the other proposals recycle revenues from shipping companies that are highly compliant. They take penalties of companies that are underperforming, and they give those penalties as a reward to overperforming ships. What none of those measures do is explain to us where does the revenue come to ensure that no state is left behind. And this is the critical point for the climate most vulnerable. Obviously, of course, we can't afford for there not to be a transition of shipping away from greenhouse gas, but at the same time, we can't afford for an inequitable system to arise where the poorer and weaker states are left bearing most of the cost and burden with no incentive for them also to transition.
And a flat levy would do that, would collect all this money and then you'd work out some way to disperse it fairly and equitably.
Yeah, exactly. That's the current debate. And in our narrative, ours is the most simple process, the most transparent process, the most easy to understand process. It's all on the table. There'd be no exemptions. It would apply to all ships under all flags. Everybody would pay the same price on the bunker of greenhouse gas fuels. And of course, the more you save fuels, either by adopting wind hybrid propulsion to reduce your fuel bill, or moving to new generation fuels, or being more efficiently operated, then you're going to save money because you're obviously not going to be paying the levy. It's what we do with that levy that becomes critically important, how we use the revenues of that for those two primary objectives, incentivizing the fleet, making sure that market leaders are incentivized to move forward with this transition, but also how do we resource that part of the world which obviously has not contributed to the climate change and simply doesn't have the economic resources on its own reconnaissance in order to bear this cost. So there has to be some mechanism by which revenues are dedicated to the purpose of elevating the position of the Global South.
Is there a risk that the Pacific could lose out in terms of higher prices for the goods that are shipped to them, of which they are very dependent, as we know? Could that result in higher prices for stuff in the Pacific?
Oh, it will result in higher prices for stuff in the Pacific. That's inevitable. And the situation is, at the moment, that Pacific countries are already paying the highest price for goods anywhere in the world and will increasingly pay higher prices. That's inevitable, regardless of what the IMO does. The European Union has already introduced its own emissions trading scheme for international shipping that came into effect on the 1st of January this year, and all other countries in the world that now trade with Europe, including the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, everyone else, is now paying to the European Union for the price of emissions. So it's not a question of whether the price is going to go up. The price is definitely going to go up. It's how do we use the revenues from that levy to offset and compensate those countries that will be disproportionately negatively impacted.
Dr. Peter Natal from the Micronesian Centre for Sustainable Transport, speaking there to the ABC's Liam Fox. A shortage of lawyers in Guam has become so dire, CEOs who hold legal licenses are being forced to take on criminal cases. They're being appointed to represent defendants on the island who can't afford a lawyer. Marion Farr spoke with attorney Joaquin Arriola Jr. about the issues it's causing in the court and prison systems.
Yeah, so what do you think is the solution to this issue and how urgent is it?
It's always been urgent. That's just it. This has been an issue that's been under revamp for many, many years. There is a provision in Guam law that allows any lawyer from any state in the United States who has their good license to practice to come to Guam to work for the government only, either as a prosecutor, a civil government lawyer, or work for a government agency, or work as a public defender. And they will get paid the same as any other local resident employee. They don't have to take the bar exam for at least 5 to 8 years. So they can practice for the government without having to take the examination. That is unlike most states in the nation. And that's one way that they've resolved the problem, by recruiting active lawyers from the mainland who want to come to Guam and not have to take the bar examination, but do government work for at least a few years until you have to take the bar.
Do you think that risks compromising the quality of lawyers in Guam?
There's been that concern. You know, there's the old people taking advantage of the situation. Maybe they can't get a job out there. Why are they coming out here? Why are we attracting several lawyers? You know, and it's been known to happen. It has been known to happen that certain people, some have come out, taken advantage of the situation and wreaked havoc. And then they take off.
That was Guam attorney Joaquin Arriola Jr. speaking there with ABC's Marion Farr. Now for some sports news. The Marshall Islands lay claim to be the only country on the planet that has never had a soccer team. But while sides representing Nauru have featured in ad hoc matches in the past, they've never had a national team playing against another country. Now a trio of Britons have joined forces with the aim of putting soccer in Nauru on the international map by the end of this year. And they include a former English Premier League player who made his name with Reading, a team an hour away from London.
Played into Kitson here, great chance, and a goal! Dave Kitson marks his 100th league appearance for Reading with a goal, his 50th for the club. He's been a wonderful servant for Reading.
As well as Reading, Dave Kitson played for 6 other English League clubs, making more than 400 appearances and scoring nearly 130 goals. But it was a mutual interest in off-the-grid tourism that's led him to join forces with the owner of Young Pioneer Travel, Gareth Johnson, and put together a plan to get a Nauru soccer team on the field with the approval of Federation President Kaz Kane.
So I met Kaz in 2020, just before the pandemic, and we tried to get something going then. It didn't happen. And then I went back to Nauru, December just gone, got talking with Kaz, we made an agreement, and he actually gave me the autonomy to get everything going. And then the big plan is to raise money, send a coach out in July, play a game in August.
Gareth called me about a year ago and said, look, I think I'm going to try to do something here, and I think I want to try and start a football team. And then it sort of ramped up at the back end of last year, and then really went into overdrive, where I said, yeah, I've done it, I'm part of the FA, and they're happy to have us there and try to help, and do you want to be a part of it? And I said, yeah, no, absolutely, definitely, I said I would, and it sounds great.
The third man involved in the ambitious project is Charlie Pomeroy, owner and coach of the Cambodian team Angkor City. He's planning to be on the ground in Nauru for a year as the new team comes together, while Dave Kitson, as manager, will make his first visit to the island in June.
anything I can do to raise PR and awareness and help and funding, any of that kind of stuff, that's a skill set that I can bring to the table. So Gareth said, well, look, you know, why don't you help to manage the first game? And then you can slip into this ambassadorial role. I think in terms of the actual coaching of the team, Charlie will head that up and I'll help him. I'll try and put in place a philosophy of how we can play, how best to go about the matches and the training based on what we have to work with.
The big question is, where will the players come from? Gareth Johnson, who's now the Nauru Federation's Director of Development, says he has eyes on those who are currently playing other sports on the island, but he certainly intends to scour the diaspora for talent as well.
So that's definitely something we're going to do. But actually, I've got a lot of hope of finding players on the island. Basically, there's a bunch of guys that are playing Aussie rules. I've spoken to a lot of them. I've spoken to some of the women who play rugby on the island. And I'm hoping I'm going to get a lot of them to code switch and give soccer a go.
As far as recruiting from the diaspora is concerned, Dave Kitson is not opposed to the idea, but he's wary of costs. And in the end, he's happy to work with the best players they can find on Nauru itself.
I see a lot of projects and I think, whatever happened to coaching? That's the whole point of coaching, you know, to try and improve people, to try and help. So going out and just trying to get the absolute best team you can for the sake of it doesn't totally square with my philosophy on football. I've got no qualms about coaching whatever we find on the island. And they're under no illusions either about, you know, the talent pool on the island because it's such a small population.
Kitson says the AFL culture on Nauru can be an asset for the soccer team, and he's hopeful of uncovering one or two gems.
Looking at that, you start to form this theory about, well, you know, whatever else we'll be tough, we'll be strong, we'll be hard to beat, and you go from there. But you're right, you know, there could be a couple of rough diamonds out there. And that goes back to my point of whatever happened to coaching. It's like Arsene Wenger said, show me the athlete and I'll show you the footballer. As long as you've got the enthusiasm and the will and the desire to get better, that's 9/10 of it right there.
A key part of the Nauru plan is to galvanise soccer right across Micronesia and to develop a strategy which will see teams from those countries play one another on a regular basis.
We're currently in talks with Palau, Marshall Islands, Micronesia and Tuvalu and Kiribati with regards to setting up a Micronesian football union. And that's kind of in advanced stages. So it'll be all the non-FIFA countries under one umbrella. Now, the long-term plan with that is to play a futsal tournament next summer.
Once the union is signed off, then the aim will be to band together and lean on the Oceania Football Confederation to give long-time associates Kiribati and Tuvalu full membership and a pathway to FIFA.
Kiribati Island Football Federation and Tuvalu as well. They are bending over backwards to fit all the criteria for the OFC. Both Tuvalu and Kiribati are good at football. They have domestic leagues. And one might argue they're a little bit more qualified than Cook Islands or American Samoa, for example. One might argue that. So one of the primary reasons for us to set up this football union is to put pressure on the OFC to help get them in. And also we can, as a group, help each other hit the criteria.
Dave Kitson says an important part of the process on Nauru is to ensure that the team that emerges is their team. The Soccer Federation has a new custom-designed logo now, for example, but only after the Islanders had their say.
That logo went back and forward hundreds of times to the people of Nauru until they were absolutely happy with it. You know, you've got to have the stars, you've got to have this, you've got to have that, you can't have this. And all we did was provide the graphic designer to make it exactly how they wanted it. So that was an example of that partnership working. We're going to be guests in another country. We're going to help as best we can. But ultimately, it's Nauru's Football Federation, and we just want to leave it in a place where they can really take it forward.
One thing is for sure, Nauru's first 11-a-side international won't be played on home soil because right now they just don't have the facilities.
We would have to go to another country. Kiribati, they've offered to play us. One thing in our favour is Nauru Airline. We're talking to them about them helping us and sponsoring us. We've actually got a number of local companies that we're talking to that are interested in sponsoring us as well. So we are really trying to make this a community thing. Long term, we want to get OFC associate membership. We want to get FIFA membership. And, you know, that's obviously not going to happen tomorrow. But if we can get FIFA membership and the grants that come in with that, then we can build fields, we can do all these things.
Above all, Dave Kitson and Gareth Johnson want to create a pathway for soccer to develop on Nauru in the future.
We're trying to create a legacy. We're trying to create something that does grow and become something. I'm not romantic enough to think that whoever we play in our first match, that we're going to win. I'm realistic in what our objectives are, and that is play at least one match, to be competitive.
And that story was from the ABC's Richard Ewart. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the region. Pacific Review was brought to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.